Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, I'm joined with Peter Olson, Director and Creative Technologist at IDEO. Before he joined IDEO, Peter was founder of and served as Vice President of Technology for Marvel Entertainment's Digital Media Group. Before we get started, some notes on where I'll be and some words from our sponsors. First up, CSS DevConf 2016 The Alamo is taking place this October 17th and 18th in San Antonio, Texas. Learn the latest by hanging out with some of the best in the business. Chris Collier, Jen Simmons, Snook, Trent Walton, and many, many more. Learn more about the tracks and sessions and register now at cssdevconf.com. The ATX web film series is showing What Comes Next is the Future and Code, Bridging the Gender Gap documentaries on October 3rd at the Alamo Drafthouse Theater on South Mar. So if you're in Austin, Texas, please check it out. With more details at atxwebfilmseries.com. Set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space show newsletter. When a new episode is ready, have it directly emailed to your inbox by setting up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Find show notes and links discussed in today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Teleject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And as always, thank you for subscribing, commenting, liking, and telling others about the Non-Breaking Space show on iTunes. Now, on with the show. Well, it's good to meet you, Peter Olson. Is it okay if I call you Peter?
Yeah, Peter's great.
Okay, cool. Yes, I'm not sure if you heard an episode or so before.
Yeah, I've heard the past few. I've heard the Simon de Laurent and... Simon Laurent. There's no day in there, right?
No, just Saint Laurent. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Dan Juergens, which is that was pretty cool to hear him. Right. And then the woman who talked about accessibility and the accessibility standards, whose name now escaping me.
Yeah, Glenda Simms.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's
the
awesome.
good witch. Good accessibility witch.
Yes. So she's amazingly positive all the time. It's amazing. Yeah. So it's a good spokesperson for accessibility.
Yeah.
So but thank you for being on the show, and I'm gonna count that as a fan of the show. I'm just gonna just put it out there. But yeah, so I saw you on Twitter a while back when you launched the Marvel API. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was amazing. It's cool. So I've been following you ever since. And then And then the Simpsons, Scorpio.
Yeah, Hank Scorpio.
Hank Scorpio. Yeah. Twitter avatar. You sold me on that one. I'm following this guy. This is great. And so I just want to catch up with you and talk about, well, one thing we kind of ask everyone on the show is like how they get involved with the web. What was your first impression? What were you doing? What was your first impression of the web? Like, how did you find out about it?
I was in college. I started college in 93, and the web obviously existed a little bit prior to that, but I guess probably after my sophomore year was when it really was starting to propagate pretty heavily into the minds of everybody at the time. And I don't know what the first website I ever saw was. It might have been just something like Yahoo back in its days when they were attempting to manually index everything and categorize it. And I remember a few things. We would use it to actually find like walkthroughs of games or things that could unlock things in games. And like one of the things that, like prior to that, like a bunch of us would do things like modem connections into BBSs and things like that, where you would have, text based or minimal, graphical user interfaces to, and you're doing kind of a one-to-one connection to a hopefully local telephone number to download or whatever. And or even like way, way back in the day, my family had like I think it was the Source account, CompuServe, but the competitor to CompuServe.
Wow, I didn't even know they had competitors. Wow.
Yeah, they had a handful of them. And so we did that type of engagement. And my parents are academics, and so they had we were able to get on to like email and listservs and stuff like that, but like even before I was in college, but like it was in college where it was just kind of starting to take off as something that was like getting outside of academic and research circles and into like the college campuses and all of that. And I think probably the first site I ever made was I was on the rowing team in college, and I was never a great rower, but I did know how to do. I was pretty good at picking up, you know, technology and you know, graphic design software and things like that. And so I did a first official site for the rowing team from my school, and it was. It was just after, I remember like the standard changed so that there was a day when you couldn't put a background image, and then there was a day you could, and it could tile. And so it was like, you know, people within the school and outside were like, oh, I did this. You can actually put an image on the background, and it can tile, and you can make, you know. And there was a lot of effort at the time making sure that it tiled just right, you know. So, yeah, and so I mean, when I graduated, it was still something that was like beginning to be a really burgeoning, you know, field for, you know, media expression and also as a career. So I kind of was able to get in right at the beginning, and in certain ways, at least in terms of it being like a commercial endeavor, something you could actually go and make a living on.
Where did you go to college?
It's called Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Okay, and what did you study?
I was a double major in neuroscience and studio art, so there wasn't a lot of class overlap. But
I like there'd be very minimal class overlap.
Yeah.
So how that is very cool. How did you come to that? You know, what drove you to do those two majors?
There's a few things. I mean, I had always. Like I studied neuroscience, so I know that this analogy is actually totally bogus science, but I have always done left brain and right brain things. I'd always done throughout, like even high school and I think even still today, things that involve like analytic understanding, you know, scientific rigor, building, working with the kind of science and building and analytical part of the brain, but also things that were expressive at one level or another. So, when I went to school, I was really, really interested in neuroscience, and I thought I was going to go into film, but I took a class in architecture my first semester and really fell, in love with doing architecture as kind of an expressive medium. And I was literally like, I came in as like, this is the hardest I've ever worked on anything in my life, you know, and really just wanted to just wish I could put more work into it and more work into it. And so I wanted to, so architecture was a concentration within the art department. So I was just like, I'm going to do this. And my parents were also like, you're not going to come out of school with an art degree. So I also was really interested in neuroscience. I mean, one of the reasons I actually chose the school is because I had a great neuroscience and behavior program, which kind of balanced biology and psychology. So I went in on both of them, and, you know, I did my thesis in art and architecture, but a lot of my course, I sort of balanced a lot of like science and art classes, and, you know, it was a liberal arts school, so you're kind of supposed to do that anyway. And, you know, so like I would have a semester of like half the time in like the architecture or sculpture studio, and the other half the time like in organic chemistry lab, doing both of those. And actually, when I took organic chemistry, my architecture and sculpture training really helped, because half of organic chemistry is actually visualizing the shape of molecules in three dimensions. And so there were like soft overlaps, if not formal academic and pedagogical ones. So,
So a little bit helped out there. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one thing I liked about, I love about the web is that you have to be creative expression, but also it requires an analytical brain to do a lot of the background, even more so now, I would say, like,
yeah,
more so now. So yeah. Cool. So do you feel like it's paid off? Like, like you actually work in your college education, if not like directly, but like, you know, it's helped you.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say definitely like the art degree or the art side of it, I was learning what at the time was kind of new and upcoming technologies like Photoshop and Illustrator. And so there was, as well as, to some degree, like the learning HTML and things like that. I mean, I would say more broadly, going to a school like that where a lot of what you try and do is figure out how to solve problems rather than coming out with like a very specific kind of tradecraft. It wasn't like some places where you'll go and like you'll do pre-med or you'll do business and you learn a lot of specific skills. A lot of like the takeaway is like actually how do you attack really large complex problems, which is something that kind of over the course of my career I've had to do in different capacities. So I think more importantly than like, you know, do I use neuroscience on a regular basis? Probably not. although, you know, every once in a while I'll come back and like get inspired by it or something like that. One of the projects we did at Marvel that me and one of my co-inventors on that we got a patent for was actually inspired by what they call RIFLIP or restriction fragment link polymorphism tests in DNA. So basically it's a way of like pseudo-randomly splitting DNA chunks so you can do DNA fingerprints. And we did something similar with large image files and ended up getting a little patent over it. I think we never actually implemented the thing we were going to do it for, but we're like, oh, we could do this. And I don't think anyone's ever tried this before. So it was inspired. Biology and neuroscience can sometimes be a real interesting source of inspiration, even if I'm not like spending time in a lab or anything like that.
Okay. Would it take you long for you to decode that patent and tell me what it does in my broken English, I guess?
Oh yeah, it was a way we were looking at ways of potentially protecting. And a big challenge with media companies, and when this is when I was at Marvel, making sure people are having enough security around things that, you know, you can keep the honest people honest, but not investing so much time in it that you're just getting into these arms races that, you know, are not really productive, and just you're spending more money trying to build security versus actually building products that help consumers. So this is a way of like kind of making a light level of security around things around the front end of content delivery on the front end without like in creating a really heavy DRM, but also making it so that, so essentially what it would do is like in DNA, you apply what's called a restriction enzyme, which, you know, DNA has got this four-letter vocabulary, right? So it goes, you know, ATGC, AT, you know, whatever. A restriction enzyme will look for a sequence of letters within a strand of DNA. And wherever if you throw it against a particular strand of DNA, wherever it just happens to hit these letters, it will yank them out. And so you get these fragments of DNA of varying length. And then from those, and that signature of the fragments is what they use to do genetic fingerprinting, right? So one person, they'll pull it out on a piece of gel, and you'll see like longer and shorter fragments, you know, in there. And that's what a DNA fingerprint does. Similarly, what we would do is essentially create, if you think, convert a, say like an image file or a sound file or something like that, and encode it in whatever encoding, like Base64 or something like that, create a random sequence of letters that existed within the letter space of whatever encoding you're doing, and then use that to just chunk the file and break it into different things, and then extract that key whenever it was found. So like a 2 megabyte file might, or a smaller file might break out into a bunch of little chunks. So you send the chunks and then reassemble it on the client side using the key that isn't shared at the time. So it's just a, like a light way of protecting assets. They're not like very easily assemblable, but very quickly reassembled, like on in an application or on the web.
Okay. So, all right, I'm gonna have to listen to this a couple times, but we're on tape now. Okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, I think getting a patent is pretty awesome. So
yeah,
that's pretty. Do you have any other patents?
I got two while I was at Marvel. One was around the digital comics viewer that we launched. We launched it way back. The one that we submitted the patent for was back in 2006, and then that one. So I've got two. I mean, okay. It doesn't really mean. It's sort of funny. Like one interesting part. Like I was on and the patent committee at Marvel. And Disney for the Disney patent committee at Marvel, and I was also on the Disney open source committee. So I was like looking at the problem of IP from both sides while I was there. But it was cool because it gave me a kind of wide understanding of like, you know, how does it, when does it make sense for a company to open source? Like when is it best to participate in, say, open standards bodies, like which, and in like we participated in some stuff with schema.org and the semantic web stuff that there, and then, you know, when does it make sense to kind of maybe hold something closer? I think software patents are a whole minefield, but there are some, you know, there's sometimes reasons where a company might want to do it. So it's sort of like looking at things you make and like how can you actually use them in a variety of ways and how does it actually help you? And one thing I'm still very curious in and try and help, you know, both IDEO and other clients we work with now is like, how do we actually, you know, we've made this thing, how do we actually use it, disseminate it, and have it do even more broad impact through the use of either open sourcing or creating open APIs or data marketplaces or make it be impactful beyond just creating the thing, but actually getting a lot of impact after the fact, you know?
I never really thought about Disney being open source or having an open source culture, I guess. Is it there? I mean, I have no idea. Is there a website I could look up more about that? Or
I don't know if there's a centralized one. Different business units kind of handle it differently. I know, like, right. If you go to I think ESPN has a GitHub page, and Disney Animation has actually done quite a lot. And Marvel, we contributed to things individually, but it wasn't like I don't think we ever released anything. But
yeah.
I mean, there definitely was an open source committee that I was on, and you know, like thinking about kind of how it could be used throughout the company, and it was a pretty broad. I mean, it's like a lot of committees, it's a big broad remit, you know, but. But yeah, if you look like, I know Disney Animation has actually done quite a bit. So.
Cool. Yeah. You know, no offense to Disney, but just like, I don't really find that they'd be great. I'm pretty sure, like, I just feel like they wouldn't be too dedicated to open source technologies a lot, but not to say that's bad, just saying that's what it is. So this is... you mentioned Marvel, so I mean, but I do want to mention like how did you get started in a web career? So what were your first gigs or first jobs? And
so. Sure, yeah. I mean, so when I graduated college, I kind of concentrated my art stuff into architecture, and I was like, I really want to go into architecture, and then I went to work for this really interesting, great architect, and I came out loving architecture more, but realizing it wasn't what I wanted to do professionally. And so
why is that?
I think there was a lot of things. I think like there was, you know, just looking at kind of the hours and the business model and all of that, like it was, and kind of how, both like kind of how difficult it is to come up and get to the point where you can be really expressive at it. You know, I think it's the same thing that happened to a lot of things with the advent of the web, is that your ability to be creative and amplify and publicize that was democratized in a lot of ways. And it's very difficult for that same kind of process to happen in architecture. I mean, it'd be interesting now with the advent of 3D printing and things like that, if that's the case. But, you know, to make a building, you need capital, and you need a patron, or you need a big company or a hospital chain or something to help you realize that. And then you have to also convince them that it is in their interest, you know, from a business and space perspective to get that building built. And there was a time, you know, the architect I worked for is named Peter Eisen, and he's written a lot of he's like, it was the type of thing, like, I was studying him in some of my classes, and then I graduated, and 6 months later I was working for him. It was really kind of an amazing experience. But he, one of the things he wrote about is how architecture used to be, you know, maybe a few hundred years ago, the way you presented yourself to the world. And now we have a variety of media by which you can do that. So whether, you know, it used to be you would, oh, I'm going to take over this country and build a bunch of cathedrals to show how powerful I am. And now you do an ad campaign. So, which is, it's probably a little more cost effective and timely. So, you know, and at the same time, I was watching and seeing how the web was really exploding, you know, here in New York and all over the world, and how it was this great engine for communication, for, you know, supporting subcultures, for, you know, taking anyone who has an idea and being able to amplify it in really interesting ways. And I felt like it was, to me, like, that was really exciting. So, you know, I started out just like literally just doing freelance work. And then I went to, you know, an early kind of this, and this was kind of the early high heroic period of the .com boom. You know? So, I went to a company that did, they managed a handful of web properties. So some of them were things like kind of more general entertainment sites, but we also did a lot of kind of official celebrity websites. So we did like Cindy Crawford's first site, which was interesting. We did Britney Spears' first site. And then from there, I went to another startup that was basically a community site for teenagers. And that was a really amazing experience, partially because it made me really interested in how the web can be used to build and support communities. And also, like, that age group was so just absorptive of that technology, and kind of building and communicating speaking in a way that, like, I think had not really even seen, even by my generation. I wasn't that much older than them, you know, than our audience in a lot of ways. But I think, like, there was, you could tell there was a fairly bright line of the people who were, like, growing up with the web versus the people, like, maybe my age that were discovering it, like, in post-secondary education. So I think that's working at that place, which is also, you know, long gone with the .com boom, but was a really was very eye opening for me. It showed me sort of how communities can exist at scale, and how to, you know, build and foster communities. And, you know, both at Marvel and now at IDEO, it's something that, you know, the ability of modern day technology to kind of work at scale to spread information, to build subcultures, sometimes, you know, maybe in negative ways now. It has always been very interesting to me, and being able to facilitate that and was something I've always been interested in. So, like, you know, so yeah.
In what ways has technology, did you see, or you implemented, like, with the younger generation, and like what things worked in terms of scaling with technology, how did that work out? Like, what did you guys do?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we glommed onto which was at the time, now is so foundational we don't even think about it, but at the time was an emerging thing, which was like the rapid growth of SMS. And so we were, you know, it was primarily a website, but we built a lot of hooks into SMS, and we were seeing like, and it kind of hit Europe a little before the United States, but like there was some statistic quoted at the time, and this is a while back, so forgive me if it's slightly wrong now, but like the rate at when SMS and when it was still kind of a pay per message or pay per bundle of message service in Europe, the smoking rate amongst teens in the UK dropped significantly because they were spending their money to text instead of to buy cigarettes. Like,
oh wow.
So there were things like that where you were seeing new modes of communication, and this is also the era where, like, say something like AOL Instant Messenger was starting to pop up. But like all these new modes of like group and one-to-one communication and different modalities of like whether it's a asynchronous thing on a message board or it's a synchronous group chat, all of these new modes of communication were just kind of exploding into the general populace and were also being really sucked up by, you know, particularly, you know, at least in this instance, the teens of that site. And, you know, this was, you know, 99 to 2001 that I was there, and we had upwards of like 5 million users when I left, you know, which nowadays is like, oh, well, Facebook's got, you know, the entire country of China sized user base. But like at the time, it was a pretty, like, it was a very, you know, it showed sort of the potential that these things had. It's just, you know, at the time also there, you know, the bottom dropped out of the business market at the time for that, and things like the there wasn't really the ad market or the economies of scale you get now for infrastructure that, you know, like there wasn't the equivalent of AWS or you know, Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure that you could just really scale up to the cost. So there was, I think, you know, and that you know, caused, you know, the bottom to drop out of that, you know, whole sector for a few years. But, you know, the impact that you could have at that time, which I still think is largely, you still can actually have this great impact at scale through these technologies, was pretty incredible to me, you know. And the fact that, like, you could, say, have a site that, whose content was almost entirely generated by teenagers, and who then had like a way of expressing themselves that heretofore had never had, you know, is pretty amazing. I think it's one of these things even today, like the we get so technology is so foundational to what we do, we forget how, kind of how amazing it is sometimes. It's like the Louis C.K. everything's amazing and everything's amazing and nobody's happy. Like, you know,
right.
Forget, like, you know, you can be a kid writing a blog on Tumblr today and you can become a major media celebrity, or, you know, at least a minor's media celebrity. And people who would normally, you know, not be able to engage with the kind of regular media landscape are able to kind of become famous, whether it's through Tumblr or Instagram or Snapchat stories or what have you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I see what you're saying with that. Just like there's my hometown, a football player at the local college sat with a kid with disabilities, mm-hmm. and he was by himself during lunchtime.
Yeah.
And it was like his favorite, because no one sits with him at lunchtime. And so he had this great lunchtime, and he came home, and he has a photo, and someone snapped a photo of it, mm-hmm. came home, mom loved it, it made local news.
Yeah.
And now it's like a whole viral and went through a location, right?
Yeah.
And so, and now he goes to the team, you know, games now. He's on the sidelines now and everything. So it's pretty awesome. And like he wouldn't have that without that viral. It wouldn't have made the local newspapers, if it would have made the national Good Morning America, what have you. So I was just like, whoa, crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I get that too. But also My beef with the Louis C.K. thing is that I would be glad to travel airplanes in the 1960s where they feed you real food. Yeah. So, whereas now it's like, leave some peanuts here. In the
We're looking at it through a relative lens. And really expectations are ramping up, and the ability for them to serve are sometimes not keeping up with that. So.
Yeah, it's like also the switch-up comedians, also like Tina Fey, which is like when people clap when they land the plane. I was like all the attendees, all the passengers on the flight, when they clap. Yeah. It's like, why are you clapping? It's supposed to land. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Someone is doing their job. It's like clapping, parking someone's car or something like that. Or parking
it's like, I parked your car. Like, good job. I'm like, oh, thank you. All right. Yeah, so it's all relative, basically, as you said before. Cool. Yeah. And also, I'm really negative about that sort of thing. Sorry. But so what we're talking about now is just okay. I guess I was going to just step into it. Like, how did you get into Marvel? That's like, because Mark Waid always said that. I think it was Mark Waid said like, there's always one way to get into comics, and you just and once you find it that way is always paved over, and you can never go back.
Yeah. I mean, I started working for Marvel, and to be clear, I worked in their digital media group. I didn't have any real involvement in the creative side of the comics. Although, it's a smaller company than I think a lot of people realize. So there's always a lot of, conversations there. But I started there in 2004, and it's one of these really boring things. Like, there was an ad on the internet and I applied.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
But it was kind of a cool, at the time it was a really cool opportunity because they were at, through the .com boom, they had grown their digital media capabilities, and then kind of after that crashed, they cut that back really severely. And, they felt, I think, a little burned out of it. And this was, it's hard to think of Marvel back then the way, with the kind of cultural weight it has now. Like, this was, they were still at the time basically in their post-bankruptcy period. So they were, 5 years out of being bankrupt in Chapter 11 or whatever a chapter equivalent that is, for big businesses. And we're very focused on just how can we operate as leanly as we possibly can. So when I was brought on, there was, maybe one or two other people in the whole company thinking and working on digital. And, my remit was basically like, okay, in about 6 weeks, Spider-Man 2 is going to come out. Can you redesign our site and rebuild it? I'm like, oh, sure. so we were able to do that and to some degree handle the traffic from the movie release. We got through that period, and then we're just kind of like, how do we actually, we feel that there is a huge opportunity for Marvel in this digital space, because they just weren't thinking about it, the web, there were games and things like that, but there was, the web group was me and part-time three other people or something like that. And I just was sort of like, it's almost like kind of being like a startup founder, but also in the part of a larger company, and you have this well-known brand and things like that. So we started working on features and pushing different things out. Like, I think the one thing that early on, which now seems like really kind of dated and a little bit of a no-brainer, is just like, let's do wallpaper. Let's just like every week when the new comics are coming out, we'll do wallpaper of half the covers and, put it out. And we made a production process around it. And one thing I learned really quickly was how to make really efficient processes, because it would be kind of, it was either me doing it or like an intern doing it. And so we had to like, anything we had, like if it wasn't automated and there weren't like really great, off the shelf CMSs at the time, it was just like, doing a lot of process design and engineering was actually a decent chunk of the job.
So what is what are your tips for building efficient processes?
I would say one is do only as many actions as you absolutely have to do. So like if you're doing a bundle of things, like, you know, at the time we might do like, you know, have to kind of crop out, you know, 20 photos, 20 covers at the time from a portrait to a landscape or a widescreen view, and figure out how to reduce those as much as possible and make it as simple as possible. Assume a very minimal knowledge on the part of the person doing it. So like there were times, some of the processes we did for later on for digital comic production, was a lot of it was like actually writing scripts in the Adobe scripting languages that could handle it. So like it required just someone hitting a button as opposed to doing five steps within a thing. So, but yeah, like we, you know, and then from that, after that, like over a summer, I was working with this intern, and we're like, it sucks that you can't come to Marvel.com and read a comic online. So, and we're just like, what if we just do this? What if we build it, you know, build like a method to do it? Cause like we could get the art files if we needed through just Marvel's, you know, digital asset management. And we're just like, how would we do this? And we basically kind of were like, we're going to spend the summer and we're going to figure this out. And so over the summer we built, you know, what became the digital comics reader for Marvel.com, and then the process to back it up, and worked with you know, the publishing group there to figure out like how could we actually put these out initially as marketing and then build a business around it. And that was kind of like what is now Marvel Unlimited. That's kind of how it started, with like two of us sitting in a windowless office at Marvel, being like, let's do this. Let's, you know, and built the whole thing in Flash in like 3 months at least. And, you know, and it's obviously completely different product now,
right.
A totally different scale of business. But like, that's kind of the type of thing we were able to do, is just, like at the time it was just like, this is something we should, you would think would be here. Let's do it. And at the time there wasn't really no comic publisher had ever leaned into digital distribution in a really serious way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could do things like you could buy CDs with like PDFs of comics, or you could buy, you know, BitTorrent was starting to rear its head. And so you get stuff illegally, but like nothing, no one was ever like, no publishers were like really saying like, how can we take this seriously? And it took, you know, kind of like a demo and a prototype to show that we could create a good experience around it, and we could, you know, start to drive interest in it, and then ultimately turn that into a product that, you know, people would support commercially. So it was, you know, it was one of those things, it was a moment where we just needed to, like someone needed to do it. And it turned out Marvel was in the best position, even with this really skeletal crew at the time,
right,
to do it. And then, you know, this is the type of thing, like as it started, that started to grow, and Marvel as the whole, you know, as an organization got more and more prominent, and they started to invest more and more in the group. And so it's sort of the group grew, you know, laterally, it grew above me, it grew below me. And, you know, but like, it, you know, that type of thing, especially, you know, kind of pervaded through the whole time I was there, but especially in the early days when we were just like, we were trying to discover and explore how this can be really valuable to Marvel as a company. And value, something that can really bring a lot of value to our fans. You know, it just took people like sitting down. It's like, we're going to do this and let's figure it out, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It takes someone who wants the ownership of it. Right. So
yeah,
that's important. So, cause I know, I'm not sure what year was this, or what time frame was this, you know?
I'm trying to think that was probably like 2004, we did the work in the summer of 2005. And then like Marvel Digital Comics, and we launched a variety of digital comics, like as essentially as like a long pilot between like the fall of 2005 and the fall of 2007. So like we were kind of building up the site generally at the time. And we did things like going back to the communities, like we knew we had this great avid fan base. So we did things like created a character wiki, which is, I think, still there. And at the time was, the time I was there was always like kind of the number one feature of the site in terms of traffic, pretty right. substantial portion of the traffic, because like ultimately that's what people care about. And I think that was another kind of brave thing for Marvel to do, was just like, we're going to turn over the online presence of our characters to the fans, because they know it best, and they could, and it was a way also, again, we could scale with a relatively small staff to support, to get the character, get bios of characters that we wouldn't really be able internally to have the staff to write, so like right. the fans were engaged and could keep up with it a lot better. We could internally, and they often, frankly know the backstory better than, maybe not like every edit, like Tom Brevoort knows everything about Marvel, but like people, at least in the digital side, they would often know it better. And we did, we built out other community things. Like I think coming from like building communities and subcultures from teens, I was able to apply that to helping build products, and supporting the subculture of fans. At the same time, we built out things like the digital comics product. So when we launched Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited, that mutated into Marvel Unlimited a few years later, a lot of it was. That was kind of in the context of a lot of other activity that was going around on the site at the time. Obviously we were doing stuff that helped support, just the sales and marketing of our comics, the sales and marketing of the movies and the television shows and, anything else to push the company. One thing that a digital group at a company like Marvel, and it's probably not unique to Marvel, but definitely we felt it there, is that like, oftentimes it becomes like the horizontal for all the verticals, yeah. And it crosses. It's the thing that kind of can help glue together these things in a really intentional and cool way. And that was something that we definitely felt, there. So
right, yeah, and I feel like turning over the characters to wikis is great, because I feel like I'm not a big Marvel fan. I mean, I'm going to say up front, I'm a DC Comics guy, which is I'm sorry, but one of the cool things I love about DC is that the who's who mm-hmm. portion of it, and that just goes back into the Wikipedia, the Marvel Universe, where they just catalog everything, and they actually take the brain power, brain trust, and that's a lot of time and effort on their own creators' hands, and they have to pay their own creators creatives to actually build those things out and to turn a wiki over and to the fans. I think it's just a very smart move on Marvel's part. So that's, if not in terms of financial, and also creative too, to get the community involved. So it's just pretty awesome. And so,
one thing I think Marvel always did pretty well was try and stay engaged with the fans. I mean, even back in the age of Stan and Jack, they would write letters, and Stan Lee would write back to you. And there's some great ones, if you go through the archives, that people have found, like George R. R. Martin wrote to, I think it was Stan Lee, but one he wrote a letter to the about the Avengers, to there, and you can see how that level of engagement has pervaded in Marvel and others, and I think it's extended to the way we at the time presented ourselves on the website and the way embraced social media in different ways as well.
Yeah, and that's one thing I miss about comics back in, like, when I get it, was like, before the internet, mm-hmm. people would write letters, and the editor would pick the letters, and then and so you get this nice obviously hand-picked letters about the past issues, but you also, depending on the editor, they would give you hints of what's coming, what's the back door. And then with Marvel, it was also, you get the I know his name, the bullpen, all the time, but it was like a letter from the editor. So, and sometimes it's Stan Lee or Jim Shooter or whatever. So it was always great. And now with, I felt like I loved email, but when email people would be able to email editors and then the cost of paper, I guess, for the book, you know, they stopped doing the email, the letters in the back, the comics. I just thought, oh, man, just if a little piece of me died. I guess, so.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not what a comic book is, man. But, so talk about, you know, we talk about like, you know, Who's Who and Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
There's some great presentations you've done that are online about, I guess the Marvel API. Is that right? Is that what's it called? Or would it be something else?
Well, someone, I think Fast Company called it the Uber framework.
Yeah.
And it got like kind of expanded a little more. Like, it's not something we ever called. So one of the things, you know, as I was at Marvel longer and longer, one of the things we found that was, you know, challenging is kind of dealing with the scale of, you know, Marvel had been telling stories since 1939, you know, this giant soap opera that's been running. This isn't unique to comic universes, but I'm sure like DC and Marvel, it's probably one of the more complicated ones because these stories run for crazy long. It's like, you know, if you look at the Tolkien universe, you know, at a certain point it stops. You know, the Frodo leaves the plane, and, you know, goes off to see the Valar or whatever. And Marvel and DC and other big comic universes keep going, you know, even the Star Wars universe, like until the new movies have stopped, right? You know, it's like anything, even like stuff like the Clone Wars cartoon was kind of pre-filling, you know, up to the episode 4 and or episode 3, I guess it's all between 2 and 3. But and so that created this huge challenge of how do we actually represent this? And it was sort of two things. Like, one, kind of how do we make sense of it, and how can we ultimately make sense to our fans, both from, you know, presenting stories and grouping things in a coherent way, in a way that's understandable, and also reaching different audiences. So like a mom or a dad who has a young kid who's really into Spider-Man may not care about the nuances of Miles Morales Spider-Man versus Ultimate Peter Parker Spider-Man versus Spider-Man in the 616 universe versus Spider-Man, you know, and all of that. They just want to have Spider-Man stuff, whereas many fans are very interested. Like, I just want to know about Miles, or I want to know about, you know, the core Marvel Universe Spider-Man. And then even within a storytelling universe, you have like the example I've given a lot is Hawkeye, where he started out as a villain, then he became Hawkeye, then he was Goliath for a while, then he was Hawkeye again, then he was dead, then he was then he was Hawkeye, you know. And then there's other characters who've assumed the mantle of Hawkeye and things like that. And the way we had up until that point, just as a company, modeled that stuff was fairly static. So there's this thing called Hawkeye in the database. We found that there needed to be a much more nuanced way of doing that. So we kind of started to tease it apart, and we found that like using graph theory was kind of the only way to do it. So we looked, you know, graph, you know, I had never studied that in college, like that kind of particular branch of math and computer science. And I kind of came across it like looking at just like, how do you approach this problem? And it turned out to be a really great fit for modeling this very complex and shifting universe. And so...
So how would you describe graph theory?
I mean, it's really, it's a very, at its core, it's pretty straightforward. It's and simple. You break things out into things and their relationships. Like you look at, you break, you know, things out, and they could be people, they could be entities of different types, and you look at how they relate to each other. Mm-hmm. And it kind of turns traditional data modeling on its head a little bit, which is like, if I'm creating like a schema in like MySQL or PostgreSQL or something like that, a lot of the time, and I'd been in, you know, business conversations where this happened a lot, like people get very like focused in on like, what is the, you know, is this a, you know, is this a string? Is it a number? Is this property? This, you know, and get very, very, and you get very focused on like the details of properties of things. And then you'll say, oh, well, that relates to this and this relates to that, you know, and so looking at things with a graph perspective, you just, you look at how things relate primarily. And you know, a lot of these, you see the lines with like circles and lines connecting everything. And what's interesting about it is there's been so much work done against it. And it really had it'd been around as a theory for a long time. I can't remember off the top of my head, the mathematician who first started to do it, but he was like trying to find ways, like, can you cross 7 bridges across a German river and not repeat your path or something like that. But with the advent of simultaneously with the advent of the large social media sites and with Google trying to make the web less strings and more entities, there've been a lot of work in a resurgence and kind of research and understanding of how this works. So the kind of for free thing you get when you start to model information as graphs is a set of very powerful mathematical tools that allow you to analyze it. So it starts out with things like modeling in a traditional database, like friends of friends of friends, becomes somewhat computationally complex, but in a graph representation is much kind of easier to do. And then things like who are the big fish in the big pond? Who are the characters that connect other, in our case, characters that connect to other characters? Like one thing we found when we started doing this type of analysis, like, so there's a big Marvel universe, right? And then there's a bunch of kind of little satellite ones, like the Ultimate Universe or the Squadron Supreme Verse or the, you know, there was like a whole universe where like everyone was covered in cancer. It was like all kinds of things like that. And we could see like which characters were actually big connectors between it, or in the main Marvel universe, like which characters became big, kind of the glue characters for, between the big franchises. And you could even do things like with a naive clustering algorithm, we were actually like able to tease out all of our franchises without like the algorithm knowing anything about our characters, just by looking at how they relate. So like how many times has this character appeared in this comic, in a comic with another character, things like that. So this was something where we really leaned in to just understand the intellectual property better. And also even things like, how do we group comics into stories and be able to kind of break out of the periodical structure that is inherent to comics? And so that's like, if you are publishing, you know, comics are kind of organized like magazines, except that like, if you subscribe to like the New Yorker or Cosmo, you know, you get one issue every month or every week, and number one comes after number two. And at the end of the year, there's a new volume and it's very regular. Comic series kind of appear and disappear fairly frequently. They rename for pretty commonly. They number in strange ways. Like there was a point at which we had to change our whole data model because they changed comic book numbers from an integer to a float.
Yeah, because I
point ones and point fives and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, DC did that with their villain issues, I guess.
Yeah. And then and especially like we live in the age of Netflix and Marvel Unlimited now, right? And so if you're a Marvel Unlimited subscriber, there's thousands or tens of thousands of comics that are available. And maybe the original periodical structure that was published in is not really the best thing in terms of reading a long story. Like you have a big event, you know, that might have tie-in issues that can help enhance the story. Maybe you just want to follow a character, maybe not even the main character. Like what if you reorganize all of Spider-Man and just followed Mary Jane throughout it, you know, something like that. So like it gave us tools to kind of slice and dice the data, just for some really tactical things of just like, if someone's looking up Spider-Man, can we actually give them comic books that Spider-Man shows up in? To like really interesting new ways of potentially telling these stories. You know, to the extent those have been implemented, who knows? And then towards the end of my time at Marvel, we released the Marvel API, which I thought was a really, again, like I think it harkens back to the theme of like we always wanted to make sure our fans were engaged in different ways, and this is just a new way that they could stay engaged, right? Where and there's some cool stuff like that's been done with it. Like the Wall Street Journal has done all this analysis of like the color usage in the covers using the Marvel API. I have like, if my Twitter background is actually the entire run of like 700 issues of Uncanny X-Men broken down into its colors. So each line is basically one cover kind of condensed into a 16 color single pixel thing. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, as a nerd, I am, it's like kind of Rob Gordon from, was it High Fidelity? Like finding his ultimate record ordering. Yeah. I find that totally, awesome that you can find that and find those relationships. Cause that's one thing that I spent most of my time with, you know, with comics growing up, was like trying to find ordering everything and documenting everything. And then, you know, then some publisher comes up with a point one numbering system and you're like screwed. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, and it's also like, you know, they do these things for a reason, and sometimes it's a perfectly good reason to signal something to a fan. Like, I'm going to renumber Fantastic Four back to issue one because a creative team has changed and it's a new storyline. It's a good kind of signal. But when you're looking at it archivally, and you know, the modes of media consumption are changing pretty radically now, and I think people do look at things in an archival way. Like, you know, you binge watch on Netflix. You don't just wait every week for the new episode of something to come out. Yeah. Some, you know, people certainly do still, but it's not the only mode you can do it. And that creates, I think, really big challenges organizationally, which is why, you know, we worked with things like creating APIs, creating, you know, graph models, working with schema.org, you know, all of those things to help kind of ourselves and our business and also our fans get a better, you know, be able to engage with the product better.
So, but now you're at IDEO, which is a great company. So how did you choose to go from Marvel to IDEO? Was it just different challenges, or was it just...
Yeah, there's a few things. I mean, I'd been at Marvel 10 years, and that's a long time to be anywhere. The second thing, like there's things we at IDEO that we're looking at. I'd say one thing I found more and more that I got more and more interested at Marvel was not just how do we make innovative products, but actually how do we change Marvel and Disney to become more innovative? You know, so like I started to look at ways, you know, of not just impacting the things that we were doing, but impacting the organization and culture as itself. And that type of challenge is something that IDEO does now on a regular basis. So it's not just, it's beyond just like products that we design and make. And certainly we make a lot of and design a lot of really cool stuff. But oftentimes we're looking at ways that through the process of design, we can have a really, really broad-based impact in the world and inside organizations, and whether that's like explicitly helping an organization, you know, find its purpose or redesign itself, or through the process of designing a product, help them kind of center and reorient around it to support and launch that product. So, you know, so this one thing was kind of like the scope of challenges that like we can really think about and work on here at IDEO has changed, and also like just different kind of materials to work with, material in a very broad sense. So like, you know, one day we might be looking at something that, you know, we're actually working on Arduinos and doing stuff in the physical space, which is just not, you know, something we tended to do at Marvel and in the digital media group. And other times we're looking at organization and really highly strategic stuff. And, you know, oftentimes I'm still like working with data and working with APIs and all of that. So it kind of, there's a broader scope of things. And it's certainly not a diss on Marvel, but definitely a change in kind of the focus and impact I was looking to do with my career. So, It's not easy to leave a company that you've been at and that, you know, leave an organization within the company that you kind of helped build from the ground up. But it was also just like kind of like the right time and a right opportunity. And IDEO is such a interesting, crazy place to work that it was a good move to make.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying, like this different range of projects, you know, keep you interested more so than. And you've been at the IDEO for a few years now, so...
Yeah, I guess I should kind of explain what IDEO is. So we're a design consultancy. IDEO was founded in the 80s and like originally did things like Apple's first mouse and Microsoft's first mouse. And now we definitely do things like that as well as, you know, digital products and also look at like, you know, how do we make organizations themselves more innovative? How do we make, you know, movements happen that can affect society sometimes in interesting ways? So like our scope of work goes everything from like, how can we create, you know, interesting or powerful movements in society down to like, let's make this product or make the services that can support a product. Like, so we're doing it, like we'll work on anything from like, we have a challenge right now on OpenIDEO, which is one of our kind of public facing innovation crowdsourcing engines around making reducing food waste globally to things like I worked on an app for everyday fashion earlier this year, so it's like it's all over the place. I've done some work there. Like I've done a certain amount of work actually for the government, making the government more collaborative and sharing, making certain parts of the government share knowledge better, which helps us all as taxpayers, hopefully. And other parts are like, we're going to be launching, we worked on recently about making New York more resistant to floods. We'll be launching in the next few weeks, probably.
Oh, wow.
That's been pretty cool because it's you know, in our backyard here, and it's something that like we as part of that, like as part of the design research process for that, we were visiting people who had been affected by Superstorm Sandy, and looking at like kind of how sometimes fragile the New York landscape is, and it gives you that gave me a very new perspective on New York. We use what's called design thinking, which is really just a way of like looking at all of our problems, no matter what the need is, no matter what the client is, from the lens and the understanding that the people who are going to be affected by what you build. So whether that's the consumer of an app or someone who might be using a service that we design, or, you know, the member of the organization that the tool, you know, the knowledge sharing tool is for, is really understanding and listening and being really one-on-one with them so that what we design is helps them, you know, meets their needs and all of that.
Is that design thinking? Is that what it is? Is that just thinking about in terms of more interaction with the user or consumer, I guess?
Well, it's getting, I guess you could say it's sort of three things. One is like getting empathy and understanding the user. And I think it's the user. And then once you know that, like understand like the business needs of the person, you know, whether that's a nonprofit or a government entity or a for-profit company, like what do they need business and operationally to be able to support this, and what do they need to get out of it, and also what can be done within reasonable technology, you know, today. So a lot of the times I'm kind of looking at all of those, but we always start with the user, and there's a whole Venn diagram of like, you know, because a lot of the times like you might start with like looking at the technology first, and you could come up with some really great technology, or you might end up with something like Google Glass, which I think is an amazing piece of technology, but had trouble really kind of resonating with consumers and finding a market. And sometimes you'll look at like, a lot of companies will look at the business, like what's going to make us a lot of money. And they'll end up with something that probably may or may not make them money, but is not always, maybe doesn't maximize that because they're not understanding the users who are using it. So like imagine like, you know, ATM fees. They make a lot of fees for banks, but it also hurts their brand and makes them seem colder and, less responsive. Or like, you know, some car companies will, or rideshare companies will increase their prices by significant amounts when they're busy. And that's a totally economically rational decision, but it you know, then their competitors use it as ads against them. So we always start by like, what do people need and how can we turn that into designs? And then that's kind of the first step. And then the second step is is building and actually making things to take the hunches and the insights we've learned from that first step and prototyping. We go through a whole process of like prototyping and synthesis and taking the learnings, playing them back, testing them with designs, testing them with prototyping. So it's a very, working very tangibly as opposed to, you know, making a PowerPoint deck and say, go build this, you know. That's also a way of ultimately reducing risk, I think. You know, so like it is fun and everyone has, you know, it's fun and creative and all that, but it also helps actually, you know, that ideas quickly and early, and then make sure that they are actually buildable and viable and all of that quick. And also it's a great forcing function. Like it's very easy to say, well, we should build this thing, and then doing a quick prototype says, yeah, maybe not, or maybe we should, or well, let's build it with do this and this and then combine that. So like a lot of, you know, prototypes can be everything from like sketches to fairly robust data-driven things to, you know, 3D printed things to we, for the flood resilience project, we made a VR using a Google Cardboard demo of what your where you're standing using Google Maps and the cardboard and the flood line of Sandy, so you could see like where the tide line would hit where you were, which could help really contextualize the problem to people. You know, and also was like good to get to get people to demos and things like that.
According to LinkedIn, your job is a creative technologist, which is an awesome title. So I just want to say, like, what is a day-to-day job for a creative technologist?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's a loaded term. I kind of do a few different things. One is like helping kind of find new clients and new work. So like, you know, figuring out like, are we a good fit for a particular challenge? You know, how can we actually create a project with a client that would be, you know, important for them and fun for us all of that. I work in project teams. So one of the things that's different from IDEO is different from a lot of companies and a lot of even like a lot of other consultancies, where a project team at IDEO like works on a project from beginning to end. So it's not like, oh, we bring in the developers at the end, or we bring in, you know, a research at the beginning. Like every project team is a kind of interdisciplinary group that is thinking about a problem with their own kind of individual lenses. So like if you have like a team, you might have a team that's like a writer and a design researcher and a software programmer all working together on or as we sometimes call them, software designers, on a particular challenge over, say, you know, 10 to 12 weeks, or sometimes longer, sometimes shorter. I think the top of the bell curve is like 10 weeks, but and so you're kind of working in like these little pods from time to time. So I work on project teams and help, particularly with clients that are like undergoing some form of digital transformation, or are working on launching a digital product, or in some cases like I where I might have some other expertise, like if there's a media client or something, I'll sometimes work on those. You know, help, you know, work on those project teams to get the to get the project out. I mean, it's funny. It's like sometimes I'm cutting code and I'm like working across a bunch of different programming languages and getting stuff out the door. Other times it's a lot more like strategic and upstream. Like
that sounds pretty awesome. I like that. Sign me up. Where do I go? thank you so much for your time. And how can people follow your awesome Twitter avatar?
I know my Twitter name is kind of weird because it's like the result of an inside joke that's lost all meaning. But it's Deathtron 5000, DETHTRON 5000. And you can, it's kind of the same on like every social media platform. So, yeah, and I'm excited. I think there's a lot of, you know, to me, like, we live in a time now where, like, there's, I think there's this explosion of really interesting technologies that can be used in really creative and human-centered ways right now. And that's everything from, you know, VR and AR to the rapid advances we're seeing in machine vision and computer and the kind of broad set cluster of AI technologies. So it's like, I feel like, to me, like, the, you know, getting back to the right brain, left thing, brain thing, like, that's where, that's the thing that, like, makes me get up and go to work every morning, is, like, we have this opportunity of using technology in a creative way to help humans and to work with humans' needs, and not, and, you know, not necessarily lead with the technology, but become, this technology is now a new design material. And to me, like, that's, like, you know, why I get up every day. It's like, how do we actually use this stuff in more and more creative ways to help, you know, to help people and to help, you know, businesses and to help organizations. So, you know, think, so yeah, that's where I'm at. That's where I'm at now. So thanks for having me on the show.
Oh man, it's my pleasure.